Hello, everyone. Robbie here. I'm pleased to announce my newest novel, War on Halloween, is out July 26th. Here is a brief description. Laurel City doesn't celebrate Halloween, and Mike Dawson wants to change that. New in town, he's going to throw the biggest Halloween party the town has ever seen. But Reverend David Laurel stands in his way. Laurel is a direct descendant of the founder of the town, and Halloween is more than just a celebration of sin. It is a direct attack on control of his city, and he won't surrender it without a fight. Mike and his children are drawn into a feud over the holiday, and Mike won't back down despite pressure from Laurel. And then the killings start. The town is thrown into chaos by brutal murders, and Laura blames them on the sinful holiday. But Laurel has a secret. Deep in his church lies an ancient book bound in red leather. It contains terrible power written in an inhuman language. Reverend Laura will do anything to stop Halloween, including summoning demons. The question isn't if Laurel City will have a Halloween. The question is if the town will survive it. Always wanted to write a Halloween horror novel, and it is finally here. It's great for fans of Stephen King's It or Stranger Things, and it's up for pre-order on Amazon right now. $3.99 for the ebook and $11.99 for print. I've worked very hard on it, and I'd love for you to check it out. I'm Robbie Dorman, and this is The Serial Fanaticist, the podcast for fans of everything. Welcome! Today, I'm joined by Brian Green to talk about the 1982 horror classic, The Thing. The Thing is my favorite movie of all time, and Brian had never seen it, and we talk about it. We discuss the gore effects, the huge cast of character actors, and the grim ending. Brian was kind enough to join me in this discussion and to let me opine about my love for the film. It's full of spoilers, if that's not obvious, so please go watch it first. On to the discussion. I'm here with Brian Green, to talk about my favorite movie of all time, The Thing. Brian, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. I got to watch The Thing again. I'm always makes me happy.
I got to watch The Thing for the first time.
That's true. It is your version.
I certainly was. I'm not no longer though.
No. I was considering, you've talked a big game about the lack of movies you've seen in your life. And I consider, you know, like, go ahead.
Everyone expects me to have seen like every movie, and I have seen the 2019 Cats two more times than I've seen The Godfather, which is zero times.
Godfather's a good movie, Brian. Spoiler
alert.
I've heard. Godfather's, I haven't seen Cats, but I'll tell you, Godfather's better than Cats.
I'll tell you this, Cats in the theater is my favorite theatrical experience of all time.
I saw Snakes on a Plane in theaters, and that was a good time too, so I can't fault
you. I'm sure it was.
I can't fault you for that. Sorry, but I was considering, like, what if we do more of these where you've not seen a movie and I have, we would call it Like a Virgin.
Oh, that's good.
And
I like that.
I don't know how long that analogy will play. Like, after how many virgin jokes are we gonna make before we get tired of it?
Right. Okay. Actually, I had an idea to do that with a friend called I think Cinematic Blind Spots, I think is what we were gonna call it, and we never did it.
There is currently a podcast doing it right now. It's called Feels Like the First Time is what it's called. And there's a very well-known podcaster leading her friend through these gigantic, like, Star Wars. Literally not seen any Star Wars, and they watched all of Star Wars.
Wow. Wow.
Or aliens, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. Mm. The Thing. I love The Thing. Let's stop talking about other crap. The Thing, 1982, my favorite movie of all time. My favorite horror movie, my favorite movie in general. I just love it. I could watch it over and over again. You've never seen it before. What are your expectations?
You know, so I went into it knowing that it was going to be a horror movie. I knew Kurt Russell was in it. I knew it took place in Antarctica, and there was a lot of kind of paranoia stuff going on. Body horror and, you know, scary monster stuff. I loved it. You know, I went into it knowing that I was going to be catching things that Stranger Things had referenced, because I'm a big Stranger Things fan, and people are like, well, how can you love this if you've never seen the things that have inspired it? I'm like, well, you know, it's referencing good things. And so literally, it can be good if it's referencing good things, right?
Good the things.
Yeah. Hey. But no, it was fun. It's
fun.
It's a fun movie.
Yeah, fun movie. Fun. You used the word. A lot of people wouldn't use word. I mean, I would. I agree with you 100% of the time. I think the thing is fun.
I love a good movie. I love a good movie that will scary and tense. And, you know, I had fun watching this movie. I really did.
Did you? Did your wife watch it with you?
She did. Yes.
Oh, okay. Good. Would she also describe it as fun?
She liked it. Like, we both, at the very end, we were like, we go, whoa! with the cameras panning back, and then you get the title card. Yeah, we both just screamed and yelled. It was great.
Okay. Most people who've seen it think it's good, but then they're also like, it's hard to watch, and it's heavy, and it's grim, and it's depressing to some people. I guess normal people, maybe.
So the hard part for me to watch, the hardest part, and this will be no surprise to you, the dog stuff was especially hard. It was like, the moment you start the movie and the Norwegians are shooting at the dog, I'm like, oh no, and then that's nothing compared to what we get later on.
I mean, you have a representative in the film. You have the dog handler, Clark. He is you. He cares more about the dogs than the people.
Yes, he does.
Unfortunately, Clark does not make it.
No.
No spoilers. No one. We're full spoilers, by the way, Brian, just in case you were concerned.
Oh, yeah.
In the intro, I'll tell people to go watch this movie. But hey, if you're still listening and you haven't watched The Thing, and you should go watch The Thing, because it's the best. The dogs, it's rough. To be fair, the dogs are kind of integral to the plot. They are not, this is not just, hey, what's, throw in some animal death just for the hell of it.
Oh, right, for sure.
They matter. It's honestly some of the best dog acting I've ever seen in any movie ever.
Oh yeah, there's the part where I think MacReady gets back from the Norwegian base, I think, is like there, and he's the dog's watching the helicopter and them getting off the helicopter. That was good.
Yeah.
The dog goes through a whole range of emotions in that moment, I think, watching MacReady get back.
Dog's like, oh man, they made it. Now they're going to think they have evidence. Oh, they know more. Now they know something. They saw what happened over there. I do want to point out that if you spoke Norwegian, they spoil the entire movie in the very first 2 minutes.
Really?
Because they literally yell at everyone. All the Americans, they yell, that's not a dog, it's an alien, it will kill us all. In Norwegian.
That's funny.
Yes, but unfortunately they don't speak English, and they just open fire at people, at a dog, and they look like nutcases. I don't know where to start with this thing, Brian. I love I probably make that the stupid thing joke over 100 times during this recording, because I'm going to say the thing. I love this thing. I love the thing. So it's hard for me to get distance from it. I guess that's you're going to help me, because
okay,
it's all new to you. Released in 1982. I don't know how much I'll give you. There's background information on the thing. Released in 1982. A remake. Did you know that? It was a remake?
That's what I've heard.
Okay. It is one
I also had someone on my Facebook post say it's not a remake, which was confusing to me.
No, it's a remake. Just it's one of the ones that is drastically better than the original. Right. They are both the movie, and the original movie is just a schlocky B movie from the 50s with a big rubber monster that doesn't really resemble this movie or really resemble the original novella that both are technically based on, but it's still a remake. It's still based off the same properties. I don't know who on your Facebook is telling lies, but they need to be they need addressed. But it bombed, did terrible. 1982 made no money.
Mm-hmm.
Had terrible reviews. Everyone hated it. I mentioned the words instant trash. That was one of the reviews, I believe, from New York Times, labeled The Thing instant trash.
New York Times has said the same thing about me, though, so.
when you're born? Or?
Yes, actually, yeah. August 26th, 1987, there was an article on the front page, just instant trash, born yesterday.
But I don't remember the first time I saw the thing, which is kind of upsetting to me because it feels like I should remember, but I feel it's like one of those movies that I've just watched and watched and watched and watched, and I've loved it more and every time. And I think that's true this time, this experience watching it again. I watch this movie a lot. I don't know. It's like comfort food for me, which I think I tell people that they think I'm crazy.
Mm-hmm. Have you been watching it your whole life, or was there do you remember a vague age of when you first saw it?
No, I don't. I knew I was a teenager. I assume mm-hmm. I saw it on cable television when I was a teenager, because that's when I saw every movie ever.
Right.
Even movies that haven't come out yet. That's when I watched them. But I assume that's when I saw it, and I don't know. I think I grew to love it in college, and now I don't remember a time as an adult that I didn't love The Thing. But I feel this experience, every time I watch it, I grow more appreciation for it. And I think that's true for this time. I was literally texting you as I was watching it, just screaming about how great this movie is. Let's start with the cast. Kurt Russell.
Let's do that. Mm-hmm.
R.J. McCready. Just at his, this is the Kurt Russellest movie that Kurt Russell has ever been in.
Yeah, he was he's fantastic in it.
He doesn't really have you seen any other of John Carpenter's Kurt Russell movies?
So I was going to save this for later, but I have not seen a single other John Carpenter movie.
Oh, well, good. That's good news. That's good news for this.
I was going to save that for the end. I was burying the lead and I was hoping to save that for later.
No. I mean, I was going to ask you. I in mind, I'm like, I need to know if Brian. So you haven't seen Escape from New York?
I have not.
No, of course.
I haven't seen They Live. I haven't seen any of that.
Halloween?
I have seen Halloween a long time ago as a teenager. I cannot tell you. I've remembered very well.
That's a John Carpenter movie. That counts.
Okay.
I mean, it has Mike Myers in it. It's the first slasher movie, proper slasher movie, aside from, like, Psycho. If you want to count Psycho, I guess. But that's not really a slasher. Not in a proper, like, Friday the 13th type movie. But, you know, Kurt Russell is in a lot of John Carpenter movies. They're close friends in real life. But Escape from New York, Big Trouble in Little China are the two other prominent ones. He's also in Escape from L.A., but let's not talk about Escape from L.A., we can talk about mm-hmm. that as little as possible because that movie is very bad. It features Kurt Russell and Peter Fonda surfing on a very bad blue screen wave in the middle of Los Angeles. And like
that sounds fun to me.
It's you like cats, so I don't know how I'm, maybe you would like it. Escape from LA is not as bad as Cats, I assume, but it's still Kurt Russell saves the world by playing basketball really well.
Cool.
That happens in Escape from LA. But it's an all male cast, which I love. The only female voice you hear in the movie is the chess wizard, played by Adrian Barbeau.
He really should not have poured his drink on that machine.
It's a cheating bitch, Brian. But that comes back around. That's it immediately tells you a lot about MacReady and about the kind of situation they're in, where he's playing chess with a computer. I guess a computer that is strictly, it's like only made for chess. That computer does nothing else.
It was quite the machine.
It's just a chess wizard. They don't have, in 1982, that computer, all it did was play chess. And considering how considering how expensive computers were in 1982, that thing probably cost a lot of money.
Yeah, that's what that's why I'm saying he should have spilled his drink on it.
I mean,
or in it.
I wouldn't say spilled as, like, I think he poured his drink into it. Dumped his drink in there. It's not spilled. It wasn't an accident. MacReady did that shit on purpose. But, I mean, MacReady doesn't put up with crap. And he doesn't He doesn't put up with cheating computers. But it's an all-male cast, a lot of character actors. You got Mr. Wilford Brimley and his
diabetes.
And his diabetes. He's got that. Keith David. I always do that. I always reverse them. There's his David Keith out there too. But
David is, I think, the VIP of this movie, like, or the MVP of this movie, besides Kurt Russell. He is so good.
Well, I mean, they are. I mean, technically, they're the last man standing.
Yeah, every scene he is in, I was just watching him, and he is so freaking good.
Childs. I mean, I'll ask you this, because this is a question I had, because I've seen this movie so many times. I know all these, I knew every character by name. I don't need to, you know, it's a big cast, like, for what this movie is. There's, a dozen dudes, and most of them don't have big parts. They play, you know, they all have, like, important things to do at different times, but only Kurt Russell really has a big part. Maybe you could say Wilford Brimley also has a relatively big part, but everyone else is kind of, they jump in and out. Can you differentiate between all these supporting cast members in your head?
I could probably pick out like five, and the rest of them kind of blur together.
Okay. It's very like, I can just go, oh, like, I know, you know, I can do Blair and Knowles and Palmer, Childs, Copper, Norris, Bennings, Clark, Gary Fuchs, Windows. Gotta love Windows. It's because
sleeping at that radio.
Get it, Brian? Because he wears glasses.
Yes.
They named it Windows.
It's such a rare thing for someone to wear glasses.
I don't know. He's also the window to the world for them.
Okay.
He's a radio operator. So that makes that there's a little bit. This movie has secret hidden layer beyond, you know, people getting ripped apart by monsters.
It's like an ogre.
Just like an ogre. This movie's just like this is just like Shrek. I would recommend it to kids who love Shrek. Go watch The Thing. Keith David is good as Childs. And you watch this movie a lot of times, as I have, you do recognize that Childs is, it's not an accident that Childs is the other one left standing at the end. When MacReady, every time, there's like a few moments throughout this film that MacReady is, like, Kurt Russell's our lead, obviously. There's multiple moments in where MacReady, there's an emergency situation, MacReady's trying to fix something, you know, Blair goes crazy in the radio room, just starts destroying stuff. The first person he talks to is Childs. He says, "Childs, go do this." And there's multiple moments in the film when he does that, or when other men, when they turn on MacReady at about halfway through the movie, they all look. They look to Childs. He becomes their new leader while MacReady's out of the picture. And that kind of reinforces what they do throughout this film, is like set up this kind of weird pecking order between all these guys. And, you know, some of them are, you know, have more leadership than others, even though it's not a only Gary has a gun. And so that like feels like he is the unofficial leader of the group. But as soon as things get serious, Gary's not in charge anymore.
Yeah.
And the film kind of like does a lot of like little tiny things to show you, oh no, this guy's like, and there's also kind of an interesting dichotomy because some of these guys are like scientists and doctors. And then there's another, the other side that are like all blue collar guys, pilots, kitchen, you know, cooks,
mm-hmm.
mechanics, whatever. And they kind of, there's a little bit of, you see, if you, you know, you, I don't expect you to notice this in your first watch. It's just the, like I said, it's like an ogre. It's definitely, there's a subtle.
Perfect metaphor.
Yeah, perfect. There's a subtle difference between these guys and how they treat each other and how they look at each other. They actually, apparently they did rehearsals before they ever did filming. They spent a lot of time together. And a lot of these guys are all theater guys. Mm. So there are a lot of scenes when they're not out in the snow that do feel very stagey, very theater-like. Like mm-hmm. when they're all like playing poker, when they're all standing around the steaming body of the thing they recover from their Norwegian camp. They're all in very close quarters, and it's a lot of rapid-fire dialogue. It reminds me of a David Mamet play in a lot of ways.
Right, and it all takes place in mostly one location, aside from when they go to the Norwegian camp. It's very, very play-like in that way.
So what I'm asking for is someone to make the thing on Broadway.
Well, Broadway has to survive what we're going through right now, so
I think it'll make it.
I mean, they just got pushed back to September, so
they're essential, right? They can go ahead. No,
I mean, in my line of work, they are, but.
I mean, professional wrestling has been declared essential, right? I don't know why Broadway can't be declared essential. They're effectively the same thing. But the cast, a bunch of character actors. You got Keith David, you have Kurt Russell, then you have a bunch of guys who maybe you saw them here or there in a movie. They appeared in, you know, a show you've seen one time. Or they were on there. Hey, that I recognize that guy from a TV show. Clark Richard Mazur has been on a lot of television shows. He still acts. Some of these fellows have sadly passed away. Unfortunately, Wilford Brimley is not one of them because he gets his diabetes medicine really cheap. You mentioned Keith David and Childs as being so great. Unfortunately, his part of this movie got him no acting roles for roughly 5 years after it ended.
Really? Wow. That's a shame because he's really good in this, and everything else I've seen him in is really good. And I actually just watched Armageddon fairly recently, and he's fantastic in that. And he's the villain in Princess and the Frog, and he's fantastic as him too, Dr. Facilier.
Keith David's great. He's a great actor and voice actor. He does lots, like you mentioned, he does lots of voice stuff. He played the animated version of Spawn, the HBO television animated television.
I didn't know that. That's cool.
Which is much better than that terrible movie.
What movie?
I mean, it's terrible. I still like it. I'm not saying I'm not good enough not to watch it, even though it's a terrible movie. I just love the cast. The pacing. It's perfect.
It is. I've found I really like these claustrophobic suspense horror. You know, for the longest time, I had thought that I liked Aliens more than I liked Alien until a few years ago when I watched both back to back at the movie theater. And Alien was like a revelation on the big screen. That's sort of why I haven't seen this movie. I'd been putting off seeing The Thing because I wanted to see it on the big screen, and Alamo Drafthouse, yeah, they show it pretty frequently, and I had just been putting it off, and you know, thinking I'll see it next time they show it, and they actually showed it back in I think January, and I was busy the night that, and I'm sad that I missed out on that because I would have loved to have seen this on the big screen.
You think they'll have a movie party for this?
I don't think it's a movie party. I think it's just a straight screening.
I know, Brian. That's what I want. I want a dumb.
They've had movie parties for weirder things, so.
Okay. I don't think they're going to have I don't expect them to have a movie party for The Thing, but I would love it. But the pacing is perfect. the tension ratchets up, ratchets up, ratchets up. You know, so, you know something's wrong with that dog. You're mm-hmm. like, what's with the dog? Why is why are they trying to kill that dog? The camera focuses on the dog a lot, and if the dog was just some normal dog, that camera would not be following that dog around, especially as he walks into people's rooms and we just see their silhouette. We don't know who they are. But you don't see, because, like, and I think that this is like a very common filmmaking monster movie type rule, is you don't see the monster, you don't show the monster for at least half an hour. Half hour in is when you do a big reveal.
Right.
And half hour in, guess what happens? Half hour into the thing.
We see the monster?
We see the monster. We get the dog kennel scene, where the dog, that dog demonstrates some of the best dog acting I've ever seen in my entire life. Because it just, like, Clark takes it into the kennel and just climbs in and just sits there and stares directly ahead. It's surrounded by other dogs. All the other dogs are looking at it weirdly because they're like, that's not a dog. They like, those dogs know what's up. Those dogs are like, that's no dog. We know. We're dogs. We're smart. We can recognize our own kind. And then the kennel scene happens. And the dog, like, explodes. How do you feel about the dog exploding, Brian?
I think I screamed, oh no! I was sad because I knew something was, obviously I knew something was wrong with the dog. It either the dog had been infected or it wasn't a dog. I wasn't sure which. And yeah, I kind of screamed and goes and just went, oh no, and like, oh, I was so scared for the other dogs in the scene, and it made me sad, but I love that first shot of the monster because it really throws you in the deep end for what you're in for at that moment. Because you see that monster and you're just like, oh, okay, so this is what this is now. Cool.
Well, it is for a while, and then it gets worse. That's kind of that's the way the thing works. Is like you're like, oh, I know how it works now, and then you're like, oh, wait, actually. It's worse than what I expect. It's worse than that. But 30 minutes in, you get the dog kennel scene and revealed to what this thing is, or at least an idea of what this thing is. We get the first, I don't know, the first demonstration of what the thing can do, where the dog kind of melts away and parts of it fall off and it shoots out tendrils and tries to wrap up other dogs. It shoots up arms up into the ceiling, trying to pull itself away. It breaks itself open and shoots a flower petal full of teeth out at us, at the camera, basically. I mean, at our fellas and us. I don't know if you noticed this, but that flower petal was actually made out of dog tongues.
Oh, I did not.
Yeah, that's the flower petal is dog tongues with dog teeth inside of it, like to try and like shoot out and grab someone, I suppose. But it just does everything right. It sets up what this monster is. It's the sudden demonstration of this awful thing because it's so disgusting. It's so gross. Like, I'm inured to it. I'm desensitized. I've seen this movie a bunch of times, and I watch a lot of gross, terrible stuff throughout my entire life, so it's hard to bother me. But I can still clearly recognize this is disgusting.
Oh, yeah. It's pretty gross.
Like, it's wet, and it shoots out, like, goo at the other dogs. It just, like it's like, that's, like... And the other dog's like, no, don't do that. I don't want that stuff on me. Even though I think it's just like, it's probably just some slime, some effects slime.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that bad. I mean, you can give a dog a bath, fortunately. But it's 30 minutes in, and the scene's not that long, the dog kennel scene. It's like less than 5 minutes long. It's like 3 minutes of yelling and... sirens, alarms, We get guns, shotguns. We get a demonstration, like, and it's not just like, oh, look how gross this monster is. It also is delivering information to you, because you see McCree taking charge, and you see him also immediately recognize Childs as, like, his lieutenant, because Childs has the flamethrower. It's like, Childs, go get the flamethrower. And also, we see a vulnerability of the monster, the flamethrower. We see them shoot the dogs, and Clark gets upset at them killing the dogs, even the ones that technically are not monsters.
Right.
So it's telling you about Clark, what he values. Everyone else is freaked out and crazy. We're just giving us a little sampler platter of what to expect from the rest of the movie. And then immediately, this is my favorite thing, Brian. This is just going to be me saying all my favorite things. But as soon as the dog kennel scene is over, we have Wilford Brimley dissecting this thing, which is also disgusting.
Yeah.
It's so gross.
He's pulling out organs and...
And he's just making these terrible noises. But Wilford Brimley making awful noises. I've watched all the special features for this stuff, and them interviewing... Wilford Brimley could not give a single shit about them asking him questions about the thing. He's like 90 years old. He's like, yeah, John wanted me to do... I thought it was stupid, but whatever. John was giving... Guy gave me a paycheck, so I, you know, I had cut open deer before. It wasn't a big deal. Wilford Brimley. But then Blair Brimley just gives a 30 second synopsis of what this thing is and what it can do. It just tells you.
Mm-hmm.
There's no mystery about it. There's no mystery about, oh, what can this animal, what is this thing? What can it do? Blair just goes, oh, it can adapt. It can change shape. It can adapt to anything and be anything. And that's what it wants to do is, adapt and change shape and convert everyone to it. And, like, there's no subterfuge about it. There's no mystery about it. The mystery is, who is it affecting? The mystery is never, what can it do? It doesn't get new powers and stuff like that. It's simple. And it doesn't, and the movie takes it, just lays its cards out for you.
And I think that is so much more interesting, the paranoia and the tension there is so much more interesting than I think any of the monster moments are. And so I think it's really smart that they lay it out there, because you're not thinking in the back of your head, okay, what is it that this monster is capable of? It's, okay, who is a monster? Who isn't a monster? And, you know, how are we going to figure out who it is? I think that's so much more fascinating than any of the scenes where they're actually fighting the monster.
Yeah, I mean, there is certainly action in it, but the action is not important. I mean, it's there to deliver more meaning, more fear, because you realize, like, oh crap, they're killing this thing, but it doesn't matter. And they don't, and especially in that scene where Blair gives the details about the monster, there's no one that just jumps in and does, like, there's no exposition man. There's no scientist man that doesn't pipe in and go, oh no, that means any of us could be the monster. they don't tell you that. Everyone's just sitting there like, what? Like, they're like, wait a minute. It can look like anything? Anything it's ever encountered, it can just look like it?
Mm-hmm.
And because it's just it's very confident. I don't know, it's very, very smart in that it doesn't have anyone say anything really stupidly obvious right away. It lets that feeling, that tension, build. It lets it lets it sit there for a second. Lets all those men standing around this weird corpse look at each other for a little bit. Let's John Carpenter score, and Morricone. I guess Morricone's in there too, but I know it says Ennio Morricone on the tin.
Uh-huh.
This is mostly John Carpenter.
Really, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, I mean there's like some orchestral bits in here. Anything you hear that's orchestral is probably Morricone originally, but anything that's synthy is 100% John Carpenter. So the title music, the dunk-dunk, dunk-dunk, that is 100% John Carpenter.
Gotcha.
Because he does, you know, he doesn't have, there's no big, you know, he doesn't like soundtracks that beat you over the head. He doesn't really use the music to tell the story or make it.
Right.
It mostly just creates an atmosphere. That's mm-hmm. all of his movies, really. But there's no, like, you know, when you watch like a Christopher Nolan movie.
Oh, God.
Yeah, exactly. You get those noises that kind of like are like, eh, something important's happening. this movie, like John Carpenter movies, very seldom do that. Ennio Morricone is very famous for his Western soundtracks and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But there's very, when you hear like some of the orchestral stuff in here, it's mixed in. But John Carpenter, I think, kind of just use that to as part of his wallpaper. This soundtrack, the unused parts of the soundtrack were used on The Hateful Eight.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Which I don't like.
I've listened to that score.
I don't really like The Hateful Eight that much, but
yeah.
You're allowed to make movies shorter than 2 hours, Quentin Tarantino.
That's nonsense. You make a 3.5 hour movie and then cut it into two movies.
I don't. Okay. Yeah. I love the soundtrack as well. It's so that title music, the dong dong, it's like a heartbeat, but it's a weird it's like a weird heartbeat, and it's unsettling. What the hell was I talking about? That scene. Exposition. We don't get any real exposition. There's really only one scene of like actual like exposition, and that is Wilford Brimley's computer. His Atari explain a computer.
Mm-hmm. Showing the cells attacking each other. Yeah,
which was done in post. That was all created. They had a computer that could do that little cell movement stuff, but all the text was added afterward. They just superimposed the text onto the film.
Gotcha.
Because it's 1982. They didn't want to make a computer program that did all that, I guess. It was much easier just to put that on the screen.
Right.
So, 34 minutes. I just wrote down times of like when things happen. So, 34 minutes in, we get that explanation. Then we get Norwegian camp, which is beautiful. I love Norwegian camp.
Mm.
Because it's just a bunch of dead people. But no one's alive. No one's alive to tell the story. It is just detective work. And it doesn't... Here, Brian, I'm going to tell you a secret that you probably already know, but you should... You are a blessed being. You're blessed.
Blessed for seeing this with fresh eyes?
That is one thing. And the other thing is you've never seen the 2010 The Thing. Which is a prequel.
It's not good.
No, it's a prequel. It is. Okay. It is everything that happens at the Norwegian camp.
Okay.
And it's very bad. Never watch it. If you're ever in the mood to watch it, put this on again.
Okay.
Because it's...
I'll make a note of that.
It's effectively the same, except worse. But it's the same. It's the same plot. It's just, you know, they just, okay. Let's not talk about that movie. I just want to give you that fair warning. And anyone else listening who has never yet watched The Thing 2010, do not watch it. It will only upset you. Norwegian camp. Did you remember? By the time we get to Norwegian camp, it's like 40 minutes in the movie, okay? And they find the spaceship, effectively. Where did they find the spaceship the first time, or is that the second time? Forget if they go. They only see the ice in the first trip, right? They only find the ice.
Yeah, only the first trip.
The second trip, they actually fly directly to the spaceship. So we don't have the spaceship yet. But I've been waiting until this moment, basically, to reference this, because the film opens. The very first thing on screen is a spaceship. Did you think about that at all?
It was not until. Did I think about the spaceship when we see it the second time?
No, or... just when the movie opens with a spaceship flying down onto Earth. It doesn't give you any of the, and then you get the title card and credits and stuff. But was that in your mind as you're watching the stuff unfold?
No, not really. Not until I saw the spaceship again.
Okay. It's the one of the very few critiques I have of the film. I don't like it. I don't like that they show the spaceship at the beginning.
Yeah, I definitely see that.
I wish they didn't.
It's a little heavy-handed.
It's my same problem I have with the Predator, the original Predator, where you see a spaceship crashing into Earth. And it's like, well, don't tell me. Just let me find out. I'll find out there's an alien. Don't worry. At a certain point, it's impossible to avoid. You don't have to give me warning. But we get Norwegian camp. We get the first human attack, which is, who is it? Goes out and gets burned out in the ice. That's Fuchs, isn't it? I think that's right.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, Fuchs with his glasses. He goes out and I think he gives a warning to MacReady, and then he's dead like 5 minutes later.
Mm-hmm.
Poor Fuchs. And maybe it's not Fuchs. Am I? Now you have me question myself. Yes, it is Fuchs. It's his glasses. Wait, no, they find Fuchs later. Man, I'm getting all this confused. Is it Bennings I'm thinking of? Maybe it's Bennings. Yeah, it's Bennings. Bennings is the
first. You're the expert, so.
I'm not an expert. I just watched the movie a lot. It's Bennings. He's the first one to die. Bennings has a hard time in this movie because he gets shot. Like Norwegian, he's the one the Norwegians shoot. And then he's the first human. He's the first of our fellas to die. He has the weird lobster hands. And then they burn him alive.
Oh, that's right. Oh, God. Yeah, he takes a lot of damage.
He does. It's very beautiful, though. That scene is very beautiful. I know that's really strange to say. The scene where they burn the man thing alive with his lobster hands and his terrible scream. But that scene is just beautiful. It's like the purples in this.
Mm-hmm.
Just gorgeous.
Sounds a good time to talk about Dean Cundey, the DP.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I didn't know he did this, but every time I see Dean Cundey, I'm just like, okay, cool. I'm in for a good ride. I'm in at least it's going to look nice.
I mean, yes, he worked on a lot of great movies. He did Jurassic Park and Back to the Future. And unfortunately,
Garfield.
Yeah, and that Adam Sandler movie. What's it called? Where he plays his own sister.
Oh God, he did that.
Dean Cundey was responsible.
Jack and Jill.
Jack and Jill. Yeah, Dean Cundey did the.
Oh no.
He was the director of photography for Jack and Jill, but apparently he's back to working on small indie films, I believe. So he's not. He's not.
He was the DP for Honey, I Shrunk the Audience at Walt Disney World.
Is that good?
Yeah, I liked it. It's not there anymore, but I enjoyed it.
Okay, you're the expert.
Except for the part where the rats like slap your legs, like crawl on your legs. That was awful.
Oh, that was that. Was that right? Okay.
Yeah.
I don't. Don't like the rats near your legs.
I sure don't.
No, but Dean Cundey, Dean Cundey is very integral to this. He got poached by Steven Spielberg at a certain point. John Carpenter, whoever's like watching the John Carpenter movies is like, I need Steven Spielberg's like, I want him. Get me that guy. He's going to do lighting on my movies from now on for at least a while. And then somehow he worked on Jack and Jill. the classic of modern cinema. The 2-hour long commercial for Dunkin' Donuts.
So you've actually seen this. I haven't seen this.
What, seen Jack and Jill? No, I have not. I've not watched the entirety of it. I've only watched multiple videos about it.
I see. And you had a lot of details, and I was concerned for a moment.
No, I just it's fascinating to me how Adam Sandler still exists. Like he makes one good movie a decade. That's how he works. That's how he for another decade the rest of Hollywood is just like, yeah, go make your shitty movies for Netflix, and then we're gonna use you in like some very like powerful drama or something, and then you're gonna be terrible for another decade.
That's how he wins, Robbie.
Have you seen Punch Drunk Love?
Yes. I've not seen it since it was in theaters, but yes, I've seen it.
Okay. Like, that's the last one. He does that, you know, he does that, and then Uncut Gems, like, 10 years later. So, he was in The Cobbler, I guess, too. He was, like, a serious role in that. He was kind of serious in that, what's the cancer, Grown Ups cancer movie?
Oh, yeah, that was, not Grown Ups,
what am I thinking of?
Funny People.
Funny People, it's right next to each other. I was reading the wrong. Yeah, Funny People.
Yeah.
With Judd Apatow. He was kind of a serious. Kind of serious? I guess that's Judd Apatow. And he's just like, it's kind of serious. It wants to be serious and funny at the same time. Yeah, Dean Cundey does
it. Was fine.
Dean Cundey is great in this movie. This movie's very purple. It's very purple and pink and blue and orangey. The lighting is great because most of the film takes place in the dark, in the ice. And yet, guess what? Never a moment in this thing where I don't know what's going on. Even when there's like spooky dark stuff happening, I can still see the actors.
That's important.
You listen in Hollywood. Why, Brian? Why do they make movies where it's dark and you can't see anything?
Yeah, I don't have an answer for you. They did that on Game of Thrones too, and it pissed me off.
You need to have better blacks in your television. Go buy a new, go buy a $4,000 television, and then you can see it. We filmed this for literally 7 people on Earth. They got the new LED television from Best Buy. Those last Christmas, they can watch this episode. Yeah, that's inexcusable, and it's not just the colors, which are beautiful in this film, but also the way that the characters are lit. The characters are lit. I usually use the word lit.
Lit.
Characters are lit. The way the characters are lit reveals things about them. But we're going to wait. We're going to circle back around. Okay. That, Brian, let me put a pin in that. We're going to circle back around. But then we get the first human attack. Poor Bennings eats it. He gets tentacled by the corpse, and then gets burned alive. And we start to see things start to fall apart. This is when we got a victim, and now things are tenuous.
Yeah,
things are tense, scary, maybe even. Did you have like a list of suspects as you went?
So as I was going through, there was part of me that had. I don't know. I had the idea that none of them were going to have been taken over, and they had taken, you know, I wondered if they were going to go that far to none of them were the monster at that point after they took care of it. That would have been, which I think would have been a bold move, but so that was part of it for a while there. But other than that, I really didn't have any major suspects. I think the movie wants you to suspect Childs, and because he's sort of, aside from the monster, I think he's the main antagonist because he is, you know, so aggressive against MacReady. But I don't know, I never once thought Childs was part of that. I think he was just acting out of his own self-preservation the entire time.
I mean, and that's part of the thing is, you know, you're not, it doesn't really matter necessarily, right, who's the thing at any one time. It could be anyone. That's the whole thing. And like, again, it's hard for me to have that perspective. Like, I almost have like a clear through line of like, okay, this is when this guy got infected, and then this guy moved to here, and then logistically, like, there's a way that you can make it all make sense. And like, this is when he got it, and then this guy came back around. Oh, this is when this is when he was infected, because the creature it hides. Like, they obey their rules. Like, the creature, unless it is backed into a corner, it does not reveal itself. It hides. Mm-hmm. And it makes them be smart. It forces them to play by the rules. Like, we can't just have, oh, the creature's angry, so it infects people. It attacks 4 people at once. Like, no, it doesn't. It's smart. The humans have it outnumbered. The whole movie, they have it outnumbered.
Mm.
But because they don't know who's who, and because of, like, because then we get Blair breaking stuff, going crazy, destroying the radio,
That was such a good scene.
It's great.
That was fun to watch.
Wilford Brimley just going nuts on some radio equipment with a fire axe and shooting at people with his revolver. I'll kill you. Yeah.
So now that, yeah, I think I had suspected him for a while because of that scene. I think there was a point where I was like, it might be him. He went off the deep end there.
He did, but my suspicion is that it happens. He is infected, but not till later. I think at this point, I think Blair is still human. We just watched him look at the simulation on his computer, and I feel like, he just wants to cut off. He destroys the helicopter, destroys the cat, the big caterpillar, the earth mover, or snow mover in this situation. And then he destroys radio equipment, and he just wants to he doesn't want people to come and infect more. He doesn't want a way to spread it back to humanity. So I think he's still human at this point. He's just gone nuts.
Yeah.
But I think at a later point, and then they separate him off, and I think somewhere between when they separate him and when he's out there isolated alone, one of the things goes out and converts him. But you don't know. We don't see it. We don't know when it happened. It could, and maybe he was a thing that right then. You don't know. He was fucking elbows deep in that corpse. That wasn't quite a corpse. It was like, you know, like he was, can it get through your skin that way? I don't know. Maybe. I'm not going to put my arms in that thing. Don't ask me.
You're not a doctor, though.
I am not a doctor. You need to be a doctor to go like, oh, look, this is intestines. They're normal. They're normal intestines, except they're in this giant, terrible monster that we recovered from their Norwegian base that was looked like a human being split in half. But
oh, so gross.
It really is. It's very gross. It's hard to outline how gross it is. It's very, very gross. And then, like, it's hard to it like it. Despite the fact, like, would you agree that this movie is a slow burn movie?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Aside when they burn, aside from the times they burn things fast.
Touche. Badoomtis. We start at this. It's at this point, like, and we're like 45 minutes, hour in, and it's at this point where everything just starts falling apart one by one. People get separated, go off into two different directions. This is when we get MacReady. Everyone thinks MacReady is one of them, and then he breaks back in with one of my favorite shots of any movie ever, where he's holding the dynamite.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got frost in his beard, and his eyes are like hollow.
And that's the shot I used to track my movie with, I believe.
It is, and it's great. It's beautiful. Like, they have the natural light coming from behind, again, Dean Kennedy, the lighting. And the natural light of the station coming from behind them as they are going into the storeroom where MacReady is there. MacReady has the light of the only light he has is there's like a distant blue light coming from outside from the snow. And then he has He has a flare and the dynamite. And the flare is like this bright orange with the blue and the natural light coming from behind them. And their flamethrower. Ugh. It's so beautiful, even though it's about a man daring them to blow everyone up. I really like the fact that no one ever calls MacReady on his bullshit.
No.
Ever. There's three different times where there's that scene. There's the scene where he has the revolver with Childs. Childs is like, well, you can go ahead and shoot me. And MacReady's just like, I mean it. Childs, whatever they see in MacReady's eyes, they're like, yeah, no, he means it. I don't want to get shot right now. MacReady is a serious, when he says something, he means it. He doesn't play around. But we get that, we get it just starts, chaos starts unraveling things. We need we find out that the blood stores have been destroyed. We have the battle over the guns. We got this is when we find Fuchs' corpse. This is Fuchs. It's Bennings, then Fuchs.
Burned alive, right?
He's also burned, yes. Yeah, so his glasses there. because we saw him. This is when the power goes out. Like, all these, it's just chaos. It's just everything is just going wrong. And it's, I just love it. I just love it. I want to bathe in it. I want to bathe in the chaos and the tension. And at this point, Brian, I need to know how you felt, because MacReady's back. He is holding the group at bay. He has the dynamite. Then Norris has a heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
It's very serious. We don't want Norris to die, do we?
No.
So what do you do when someone's having a heart attack?
You defibrillate them.
How did you feel about the defibrillator scene?
Is this where the chest opens up and
bites the man
off the arms?
Yes, it is. This is the scene.
Oh god, this is another moment where I audibly yelled. It wasn't necessarily a scream, it scared me. It was just because I was so disturbed by what I was watching. I definitely just exclaimed quite loudly about this, though.
It's, and this scene in particular is just, it's insane. It's crazy. Just the things that happen in order. Like, we have already, everyone hates each other. MacReady is holding off the rest of the people with a flamethrower and dynamite. And then we have another, Copper is trying to revive Norris. He's having a heart attack. Ah! Then his arms get bitten off. And he's screaming.
The head attaches, right?
Yes. And then they burn the body of Norris. And then the head separates, scurries off under a desk. And it doesn't even scurry. It shoots a tendril out of its mouth and pulls itself under the desk. And then it shoots spider legs out of its arms and grows eye stalks like a crab. And then it starts skittering across the ground with another great line. You've got to be fucking kidding. There's not a lot of laugh lines in this movie. Most of it's deadly serious and dread and full of dread. But that is a genuine laugh line where the stoner, Palmer, the burnout, he is just like, what the fuck is going on? Really? This is what we're dealing with? This fucking head just grew legs and is skittering across the ground. Burn that. Burn Copper, because Copper now is going to turn into one of those things, probably. He's got his arms chewed off. Or he's going to die anyway. Might as well just finish him. You know how they did the Copper bit with his arms getting chopped off?
No, I don't.
They used a genuine amputee.
Oh my god, really?
They gave him fake arms, and they put him a mask of the actor onto him for a second.
Wow.
And I think this is a good time to talk about the effects.
Mm-hmm.
Which are disgusting and spectacular. And all physical. All except for one stop motion at near the end.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else, genuine physical effects. Real goop, real monsters, real blood and guts. And this is the holy grail of whenever I see something using the digital blood effects.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I see a movie that is clearly a CGI monster chasing after people, or when I see a CGI monster get shot with something and it's clearly a CGI monster. Look at this. Look at what we can do. It's real.
That takes so much more work, Robbie. It's easier to animate.
I don't care. Look at that. The head was real, and you could tell it's real. You can see that it's actually in that shot.
Yeah, it's the practical effects are so much better. It's a lot more fun to watch.
And there's no faking the reactions. Like, they don't have to pretend that they're seeing a monster. They are seeing a monster. Look at it. It's right in front of you. It's disgusting. They don't have to pretend they're seeing something disgusting or horrific. They can just look. They don't need to pretend. It's there. It's doing work for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. Why? Because that's the other thing. Am I a crazy person?
No, I don't think you are.
Okay, thank you.
For liking practical effects?
It feels like there are more people. I'm not alone, right? I think most people, when they should be practical, you should use practical effects.
No, that's why everyone, that's why, you know, the entire world, you know, crapped their pants when J.J. Abrams started showing that he was bringing back practical effects of Star Wars.
So, why do they keep using CGI?
It's easier, because it's cheaper in the long run.
I don't think, but it's not as good.
It's not.
I like gross stuff. I want gross stuff.
You're trying to explain art to people who are footing the bill is the issue.
Why are they in charge?
They have the money.
Let John Carpenter be in charge. Let him make a bunch of bad movies before he dies. I mean, that's probably what would happen, but who cares? He deserves it. You look at that scene, and every single bit of it is a different effect. Like, the defibrillator, the scene where the arms are chopped off, that is one effect with this. They have a half a corpse. They have to have a body, a fake body that opens up with teeth and closes back down on fake arms. Another different effect applied to the amputee actor. Another effect for letting the head separate itself from the body and fall down to the earth. Another effect to have the thing crawl out, like pull itself over to a desk. Another effect to have the legs sprout out. Another effect to have it skitter across the ground. It just warms me up inside. It makes me feel happy.
It looks really good.
Why can't no more of that? Why not more?
I wish I had an answer for you.
You gave me an answer, Brian. It's money. Stupid crap. That's the other thing about the 2010 film. All digital.
Oh, no.
All CGI. Apparently, the other thing about that is they had it made. They had all the things, all the tricks done. They had made in physical form. They had, like, practical effects for all of it. And then, like, the literal thing you just described happened.
Oh, shoot.
Where a producer, money man, said, I like the CGI more. Do CGI. And then, then it looks like. It looks like crap. It looks like there are moments in this where you can clearly tell, oh, that's a dummy. Oh, that's clearly not a human being there.
Mm.
I don't care, because it's still a real thing. It's still a physical presence in the shot.
It's still being lit the same way as everything.
Yes. It looks the same. Even like when there's dummies, I just go, whatever. I understand what's happening, and I don't go, I can recognize the difference between a CGI dummy and a CGI person even in the Marvel movies, even in Star Wars. Like, I can clearly see when they're using a CGI, because guess what? A human can't do the things they're asking it to do. There's no one who has the power of Spider-Man.
Except for me, but we'll talk about that later.
Maybe go be a hero, Ryan. We need heroes right now.
I'm a teacher. I am a hero.
That was
the most insufferable thing I've ever said in my life.
I'll lean out my window and clap for you. Will that make it better? I'll beat a pot and pan. That makes it worthwhile, right?
Oh yeah.
Topical humor.
I'll take that over, you know, decent pay any day.
So we get, and this, this is the best. So we get the defibrillator scene, which I love. So good. Things are falling apart. Chaos. And then we get the best scene in movie history.
It's a bold statement there, Robbie.
The blood test scene. It's literally my favorite scene of any movie ever.
It's like, a great scene. I wouldn't call it the best scene of all of cinema.
The best scene ever made, Brian. We're going to find out which one of you is the thing. Heated piece of wire. Tension. We get Childs just staring at him going, let's do this. Not the best ever?
It's good. It's good. I think what I would put as the best scene ever is the bar scene in The Shining when he's talking to the ghost bartender.
Bring up Kubrick.
Are you judging me right now?
I'm absolutely judging you right now.
How dare you?
Bringing the lifeless.
That's a fantastic scene.
Bringing in lifeless Kubrick into this discussion.
Oh, Jesus.
Robotic.
Probably. I can't make it to D&D on Saturday. I'm sorry.
John Carpenter didn't emotionally torture his actors either, I should add. Stanley Kubrick absolutely did. The Shining is a very competently made film, just like everything Kubrick made. It was very competent. but I could watch this scene over and over and over again and never get tired of it. I never get tired of, I know what happens. There's no, like, and I think that's what's impressive to me about it is that I know what happens, like, beat for beat. There's no surprise in it. And yet I still feel the tension. I still am like waiting as that wire, the hot wire screeches against the blood.
I'm trying to remember what order do they do it in? Because I was expecting it to be like the rule of three, like the first two didn't work and the third one didn't. The first two were going to be nothing and the third one would be, and it wasn't.
No, it's how it works. That's why it works so well is because
it was good.
That's like they Windows is first, then Knowles, Windows, Knowles, then Childs.
That's it. Yeah, because I was like, oh, is it going to they picks up Childs, the third one. I was like, okay, maybe Childs is. So I was suspecting just the third one would be it.
And Childs, let's do this. He's very like, it's very much like, do it. Come on. I'll show you. And that's the very fact that Childs is so adamant about it, like immediately, I think, clues you in that it's not, you know, the creature is timid, even. Like, that shows because Palmer is, like, who is the one who's the thing, is looking down the entire time. He doesn't say a word this entire scene. He says nothing. But remember what I said about the lighting and how it reflects character?
Right.
This is the scene. Does, if you look in everyone's eyes, there's an eye light there. You know, you see the light reflecting back out of their eyes.
Uh-huh.
And it's a very common thing in film. Like, you don't even think about it most of the time. You just see it and you go, oh, yeah. It gives the actors, it gives the characters more, it makes them feel more human, right? Like, you're watching a movie and you see light reflecting out of a character's eyes, it gives them that glint of humanity. It gives them, like, oh, look. They're real. They're vulnerable or powerful or whatever, reflecting back at you. And every person in the scene has eye light, except for Palmer.
Oh, okay.
No, you look at Palmer's eyes, there's no light reflecting back at you.
I'll have to go back and watch that. Look for that.
And again, you wouldn't even think, you don't think about it in the moment. But then, you know, Childs gets tested, and one by one they are he's untying these guys and getting them off the couch, off these chairs, giving them flamethrowers.
All right, I can trust you. Here's a flamethrower.
It's a universal sign of trust. I didn't know if you knew that or not.
You don't trust me. You've never given me a flamethrower.
It takes a while. It's like after I know you for 10 years, that's when I give you
okay,
it's gonna take a while. I'm sorry,
we got a few more years to go.
Yeah, it's a while. It's worth it, though, at the end of the day. So, flamethrowers are pretty cool. Do you have a wasp problem?
No.
Murder hornet problem?
Oh, yeah. We all have one.
Flamethrower is the trick.
Oh, cool.
That's not... I wouldn't actually probably use a flamethrower on murder wasps. It's probably... Don't use that device, please. But then we get the reveal of Palmer and more chaos, and Palmer's head splits itself apart. I think my other big critique, I talked about my critique, the alien, the ship at the beginning. My other big critique The blood test scene is amazing and one of my favorite scenes in cinema history. Okay, I'm not going to say it's the best scene. I might be a little bit hyperbolic when I say it's the best scene in movie history. But it is certainly my favorite. Unfortunately, it's so good, it kind of deflates the next, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes of the movie a little bit. Does that reflect? All right. Did you feel that way? I feel that way.
So it deflates it in what way? What do you mean?
The tension. There's a little less. It's like, I don't know. I just don't feel like.
Oh, yeah. Since it's no longer, you're no longer suspecting the other people in the room.
Right.
Yeah, I could see that for sure.
And it's not that it's like not exciting or interesting. Like now they like know who's who. And now they got to try and figure out what's going on. But then we had a new problem with the power going out and Blair's on the loose. They assume they were like, oh, Blair must be a thing. So we got to go find Blair. And Blair starts picking them off one by one. And it's just, it kind of turns into a monster movie at this point.
Mm.
And
yeah, that's what I was saying about the tension is much more exciting than anything with the monster.
Right. And like I don't know what else to do though. That is the thing.
Right. You got to have a monster.
You have to, I mean there has to be a monster there. There has to be a kind of a, you know, something has to happen that escalates the situation even further, and they've moved past the point of where like, oh, they need to suspect every single person. They know Blair is probably the last remaining thing. So they have to go find him and kill him. And they find that he's been building a UFO in this little,
like you do,
in his ice cave. I do like that stupid, that little dumb UFO he's been building. I don't know how I wonder if like the thing started like building, like he formed a bunch of tentacles or something, a bunch of hands, extra hands. Because that's a lot of work to get done in like a day.
I was surprised. I can't imagine how you build that quickly.
Or maybe one of the many aliens the thing has encountered over his millions of years of survival has like can create super heat, and so he was like welding as he went. He didn't need to use even though if he had super heat, you'd think he probably would have used it in Antarctic. At some point. So I don't. But who knows. That is a direction the film did not go in. Where like. We're going to access all the things. The alien has contacted over the years. Because technically he could become. It could become anything. That it's ever seen. And if it's been to like 1,000 planets. Although does. Now I'm just thinking about like spinning out. Like well would its biology be affected by Earth atmosphere? Could it not replicate a creature that lived in like some weird, I don't know, acid planet?
It couldn't. Right. If it could be anything it wanted to be, why would it pick the dog? If it could be any creature from any other planet it's encountered.
It's probably because of like it has to be something that could survive Earth. And like he doesn't.
It needs to be able to go under the radar.
Yeah, it doesn't eat. For one, it needs to be like it does need to hide because it probably is not meant. It is not. It's probably again. It's a chameleon. It strikes in the dark, like they say. So its first inclination is not to like just overwhelm. It probably is like, well, I know a little bit about humans now that I've encountered them in the Norwegian base. I know that they can hurt me probably. So I need to lay low, be safe. Just chill, chill, literally. Get it?
I get it.
Cool.
It's not subtle, Robbie.
Yeah, I think that this is probably my, I don't want to call it like a bad part of the movie. It's just kind of like a little bit of a, it feels a little bit monstery. It feels a little bit action movie. Like I said earlier, it's not an action movie. This part definitely feels like a little bit like an action movie. Like we get them hunting for the monster, blowing up stuff with the Molotov cocktails and dynamite.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, it's not as exciting. Blair kills everybody, the Blair monster. But then there is an interesting thing that I just actually read about today, and it made when I talked about, you know, MacReady destroying the chess wizard,
uh-huh.
The very first thing he loses. So he destroys it. So he's losing to the thing. The monster has just killed almost everyone. And so what does he do? He destroys the base.
Oh, okay.
He's losing, so he destroys it. He destroys the he won't play, instead of playing the game, he just destroys the entire thing.
Okay. And even though he knows it's going to doom himself.
Right. He knows he should. It's not necessarily the right thing to do, but it is the thing he does.
Right.
There's no really, I'm not sure there's a win-win situation anywhere in here. Like, no. What does he do? There's the giant, and there's also, this is the only effect shot I will complain about, is the stop motion. It's only for a couple seconds, but it does not look as good as anything else in the film. I don't know if you've even noticed it.
I didn't catch it, but because I thought it all looked good here.
Okay. There's a moment of stop motion animation where a tentacle breaks up from the floor and pulls the plunger down, like for the dynamite.
I did remember laughing at that. Both Jenny and I laughed at that. So I may have caught that.
That's it is very clearly stop motion animation. And it kind of, that is the one effect shot in this entire, like, I don't care about the human, like the dummies, whenever they get eaten by the different things at different times. Like, there's a couple other, like, specious little moments here and there where you can kind of look closely and see the difference, but this is actually the one shot I would complain about. Like, it looks like stop motion. It looks like a fucking Jason and Argonauts. It looks like the 60s, like a
right
adventure movies, and that's not good. I don't want that. I don't want that in my movie. The ending.
Mm-hmm.
Who's the thing, Brian?
Neither of them at that point, I don't think.
You sure?
I'm fairly certain, but I could be wrong.
You don't know. No one knows. That's the whole that's the point. But they do, did you want some J&B after you watched the movie?
Some what?
Some J&B, the whiskey.
The scotch?
Yeah, the scotch.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
That's the featured prominently.
I mean, I always do. Okay, yeah, that's the thing. I always want some whiskey.
Here's the thing. I always want some J&B. That might as well be an advertisement they released in with this. Kurt Russell turns to the camera. Here's the thing. Now, here's the real thing. After I take a nice sip of J&B scotch, I just don't, less concerned. Maybe that's a secret. He is one of the last survivors. Okay, if Childs isn't a thing, where did he go? Why did he vanish in the middle of, like, right in the middle of the crisis? They told him to stay put, and he didn't stay put.
He said he didn't. Doesn't he say he thought he saw so and so off on their own?
He thought he saw Blair. He thought he saw Blair, so he chased after him. Very convenient excuse, if you ask me, Ryan.
I think it's a decent excuse. I believed him enough.
You just like Keith David. You just like Childs.
I do. I like Keith David. He's a talented actor.
He is talented.
He's such
fun.
A good voice.
He has a great voice.
His voice is so good.
He has a very good voice, and he's great as Childs. And the end scene is just beautiful. It's perfect. It is literally, this is kind of my, like, platonic ideal of a horror film ending.
Mm-hmm.
This is perfect. Because there's no jump scare at the end. You know, there's no monster grinning at you. Like, and I don't mind monsters grinning at you, or the killer, like an ironic Twilight Zone-y ending even. But this is exactly what I want out of a horror movie ending. It is just bleak and dark and poetic and understated, subtle, and even a little bit, there's even like a little bit of like gallows humor in it,
mm-hmm.
which I really like too.
I love this idea that these two don't trust each other, but they've resigned themselves to, they're just going to have to ride out their deaths with each other.
I mean, at least they got the booze.
Yeah.
It's something.
You know? They're going to die horrible, freezing deaths, but they'll be drunk.
They will be. Yeah, I don't know if that makes it any better, but it probably helps for a little bit. And then eventually you're just like, oh no, this is still terrible. Having written a book about set in Antarctica, I know all about what physiologically happens when you freeze to death.
Oh no.
Not pleasant.
It's a very,
I don't want to know.
It's very, very unpleasant. It does not, it's not a happy time.
Mm-hmm. So I want to go back real fast to Dean Cundey.
Okay. Let's do it.
Oh, well, sorry. Do we have some more to say about the ending?
No. We'll do whatever. I just was like, I just want to talk about those specific, the highlight those scenes because they're my favorites.
Uh-huh. So I was looking at Dean Cundey's filmography here, and I think I can track him, his journey to Jack and Jill back to Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Because before Who Framed Roger Rabbit, there wasn't a huge like history of actors acting against things that weren't there. Like there would have been like there would have been things like if it's a, you know, stop motion or something, but you know, characters for the most part, there wasn't much going on. So Who Framed Roger Rabbit, he is the DP on. He uses a lot of those tricks in Back to the Future Part 2 and 3. There's some of that in Hook, there's some of that in Jurassic Park. And then he also in 1997 he does Flubber, 1998 he does Parent Trap, 2004 he does Garfield. So he's doing a lot of these movies that are early CG and early mixes of animation and live action. And so where actors are playing off of something that's not there. And specifically the Parent Trap, he is working with an actress that is playing two characters at the same time. So I'm like, okay, I guess it makes sense that they would tap in for Jack and Jill.
Oh no.
I don't know why he would say yes to it, but
the answer is money.
Money, yes. Oh yeah, and also Looney Tunes back in action. He also did that.
That's Brendan Fraser, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm surprised they didn't get him for Space Jam.
Who, Brendan Fraser?
No. Dean Cundey.
I know. I was making a joke. I
would love to see Brendan Fraser play basketball against some aliens.
I think they're going to have... I mean, I would... In Space Jam 2, I would have Brendan Fraser be the Bill Murray role, basically.
Oh, God.
LeBron recruit Brendan Fraser.
That makes me sad.
Why? Why does it make you sad?
I don't know. I'm not sure I want Space Jam 2. And
no one wanted
Brendan Fraser is no Bill Murray.
No one wanted Space Jam 1, Brian. That's the secret.
I wanted Space Jam 1.
No, you didn't. You didn't know any
that
better.
That movie was for me.
you were like 6 or something? You know, like what, like 7, 8? I don't know. I have no idea when Space Jam came out. It was the 90s. It was in the middle of Michael. I have not been watching the Michael Jordan documentary or Michael Jordan propaganda, I guess is what it actually is. But
I would have been between 8 and 9 when Space Jam came out.
I mean, that is the right age to watch.
Yeah.
To develop a crush on the bunny girl.
Let's not get started on on Lola Bunny.
Lola. Yeah. I don't know. I love this movie, Brian.
It's a great movie. Thank you for introducing me to it and demanding that I watch it.
I have to. There's something in me. Have you seen... this is just spilling into... Have you seen this movie? Have you seen There Will Be Blood?
Yes.
Okay. Then you...
Drink your milkshake.
Yes, exactly. But there's something in me. There is a... What does he say? He's at the... next to the campfire. He's trying to explain... There's a competition in me, is that what he says, I believe.
Uh-huh.
There's something like that. There's a competition. Daniel Day-Lewis. I love There Will Be Blood. It's a great movie.
It's a good movie.
It's not great. It's good.
I like it a lot. It's not one that I revisit very often.
Well, no, it's miserable and it's 3.5 hours long. It's full of hatred and horror, basically. I mean, like, There Will Be Blood is, like, there's no monsters in it at all, except for Daniel Plainview. He's the movie monster in that. I'm trying to think of other things about the thing that I want to tell you that I love so much. I don't know. I think that's the other thing I want to emphasize that I don't think many people think about. When they talk about this movie, is that the writing is also really great. The direction, John Carpenter, I think most people say that this is his best movie, even if a lot of people don't agree it's their favorite movie of John Carpenter. But I think it's his best movie. I think it's his, like, the best direction, best writing, best acting, best casting. Like, I think the cast, the variety of the cast members really helps flesh out these kind of side characters that don't have a lot to do for the most part. Like, on the page, how many lines does Copper have? Like 10?
Not much.
Maybe 10? Or Norris? Or any of these guys? Like, the ones, like Clark, the kennel guy. How many mm-hmm. lines does he have in the movie? Like, five? Yeah, like, he says, like, he doesn't say much. He's, but like, they give them a lot of character by what their role is in the base, by the look of the actors, by how they are staged. Like, it draws for a 2-hour movie, it draws a lot of character out of these little side parts that help flesh out the feeling of this being a real place, of these being real people, not just disposable red shirts. Most of them are. Most of them are just, you know, they're going to... How can we mutilate these people? Like, that's a lot of ways how the thing works, but there's a lot of art in it. There's a lot of really smart, intelligent writing in the screenplay. I lived in the world where... Okay, here, Brian, this is an important question.
Okay.
And I'm worried. I'm worried about your answer.
Oh no.
Because this is 1982, the summer of 1982 was dynamite. It was crazy. The other movies that came out. You got Conan the Barbarian, Rocky 3, Poltergeist, I think one of the Indiana Jones, just like crazy. Mad Max 2, just incredible great movies. But the biggest movie that came out in the summer of 1982 was E.T.
Are you going to ask me if I've ever seen E.T.?
No, I'm not going to ask you if you've seen E.T.
Oh, okay, because I was about to be insulted.
No. My question is, you have to pick one, E.T. or The Thing.
Oh, Robbie.
You have to pick one. The other one gets erased from existence. Never existed. Make a choice.
I mean, E.T. has a ride at Universal Studios.
Oh, no. Is that really? Why? That ride's terrible.
How dare you?
I wrote it not too long ago, last time I was in Universal, which wasn't that long ago, like 2 years ago. That's not a good ride.
You get that smell in the line?
Yeah, it's terrible. It's awful.
Robbie, we can't be friends anymore.
I know, you just picked E.T. There's two types of people in the world, Brian. There's E.T. people and there's The Thing people. You have to...
Why can't you be both? I like both of these films.
Nope. This is a zero-sum game.
Okay. Gave me a terrible, mean question.
Not a mean question. There's a clearly right answer, and you just decided to pick the wrong one. It's okay.
Okay.
I don't like E.T. I don't even... It's not a tough choice for me, because I don't like E.T. at all. I think it's a bad movie.
You make me sad. You really make me sad.
I don't like that stupid alien. I don't like all those I don't like all those ugly kids. I don't like how they manipulate you by making the sad alien sick.
You don't like it when the sister calls the brother penis breath.
I don't
it's
like
so funny.
I don't like the Reese's Pieces. I don't like any. I don't. There's nothing. I like to eat Reese's Pieces. That's about it.
I was about to say, hold up.
I like the candy. I don't like how it's used in the movie. I don't like the government stuff. I don't like any of it. I don't like E.T. Here, I said it. I'm a thing, all right? I'm a The Thing man. Full through and through. I like my aliens mutating and disgusting. I don't want no cute alien that becomes, like, friends with some kid and has all his little friends and his bicycle.
That's a great movie. Or a monster.
That's fine. That's okay.
You have no love in your heart.
I have love. I love The Thing. The E.T. is not the type of movie I go to for pleasure. The Thing is. And I think that says a lot about me.
I was about to say, it speaks to your character.
It speaks to what I am. What kind of thing I am. Where I the terrible movie where dogs are shot. And men get their arms bitten off, and it ends with two men slowly freezing to death drinking whiskey. This says a lot about me, I think. I don't know. I'm glad you watched it. I'm glad you liked it. Because if you didn't like it, Brian, I don't know if I could take it. It's one of my
favorite. No, I liked it a lot.
Even if
I would pick E.T. over it.
Maybe I should just watch E.T. again, see how I feel about it. It's been a long time since I watched it, mostly because I hate it. I might like it more if I watch it again. I probably would think it's fine.
Well, go watch it and we'll talk about it. How about that?
I don't know if I want to do that. That's a little that might be a little much. Also, do you see the you mentioned Stranger Things earlier, Brian? You get the Demogorgon. There's a lot.
The biggest thing for me was the burning with like the needle and the blood and the, you know, just them having to burn the monster was just reminded me of season two where they're having to like put Will in the hot box, like they have him in the shed and they're like just like have heaters all over him because the monster likes it cold.
Yeah, the Stranger Things has a lot of, it pulls from a lot of 80s stuff, and I mean that's not, again, people use that, I don't think that's necessarily fair criticism of Stranger Things. To some people would say that it uses other influences to shape it does not make it a bad show.
No, I don't think so.
I like Stranger Things. I don't like E.T. though, which it also uses a lot of E.T. though.
Yeah, sure does.
On purpose though. I think there's no subtlety about their theft. Good artist steal. That's a little bit. Is there anything we haven't talked about The Thing, Brian?
There's a remake coming.
What are you talking about? What do you mean?
Do you not know about this?
Why would they do that? That doesn't make sense.
They're doing it.
No, they're not. That's
money.
Why are you lying to me?
Money, Robbie.
Why would you lie to me about that? Make me feel bad.
Oh, I'm sorry. There's not a remake. I was misinformed.
Everyone, there's totally a remake coming. Don't tell Robbie.
Why would they? Why?
Why? Because it's happening.
But no, but why? Now it's and now I'm Googling it. Blumhouse? No, no.
Oh no!
I don't know.
I can't believe you didn't know this.
I try to avoid it as it upsets me, Brian. I don't want to. You know what? I'm gonna be on here. There's some positive news coming out of the pandemic, because they can't make this movie while the pandemic's going on.
Jesus.
There won't be any Blumhouse productions going on because everyone's locked down. Some good news. I'm not gonna say it's worth it. But silver lining, you know, maybe it'll fall through because of the pandemic is what I'm saying and what I'm hoping. Cross my fingers. No one wants this, Blumhouse. Stop. Why would you? It's perfect. Why? You can't make it better. What are you going to do?
Make it again?
Ugh. I didn't expect to get. This is like season 14 Simpsons Angry, Brian. All right. I didn't expect you to bring this out of me in this podcast where I talk about this thing I love. But now I gotta think about a world where Blumhouse is remaking The Thing.
Okay, so I just Googled The Thing remake and it brought up a lot about the 2011 prequel that you hate so much.
It's very bad.
I didn't realize Mary Elizabeth Winstead is in it, so now I have to watch it.
No, you really don't. Go watch things.
But I love Mary Elizabeth Winstead.
And she's in a lot of like movies and television shows that are good. So watch those.
Yeah.
Go watch Scott Pilgrim again or Fargo or the Grindhouse.
Die Hard 4.
The what? Excuse me?
Die Hard 4.
I forgot she was in that movie.
Yeah. Die Hard with a Vengeance. No.
Die Hard with a Vengeance is 3. 3 is good.
Yeah.
There's two good Die Hard movies. One in number 1 and number 3. 4 is not a good
four
movie.
4 is halfway decent. 4 okay, 4 is decent. 5 is unwatchable.
4 is PG-13. I don't want Die Hard movies that are not rated R don't exist. Like I don't even rate them.
Okay.
They don't like that
at
doesn't
At least 4 had 4 had at least had actual stunts. 5 was all green screen.
But Mary Elizabeth Winstead is in this film, and it's still a very bad movie, and she's a good actress when she's in good movies. So go watch those. Like, don't watch this. This movie's terrible. I give a thing. The Thing 1982, masterpiece. One of my favorites. John Carpenter's best work. I don't know. And Brian now is his favorite movie too, right?
Sure.
Cool. Great. Now I'm happy again.
Just to appease you.
I'm a terrible monster. If you don't answer the questions I like the way I like, way I want you to, I'm going to scream and yell at you. Much like Stanley Kubrick.
I never said The Shining was my favorite movie.
You did say there was a perfect scene in it, though. The best scene.
I think that scene is perfect.
The best scene ever filmed, I believe, is what you alluded to in The Shining.
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, boy. Did you see The Shining 2?
What was it called? Yes, I did see it. I saw it in theaters, and it was very good, and more people should have seen it.
I don't need any more shitting lore. It's a good.
It was a vampire movie without vampires. It was real cool.
That's my feeling. I've read the book. I was just like, it's fine. it's fine. I'm not angry. It's Stephen King. I love Stephen King. Okay, Brian. I'm rambling about Stephen King and about whatever's. It's the time of the night where my brain just turns into mush. So why don't you plug stuff? Tell people about things they should check out that you participate in.
Yeah. So you can hear me every other week. We release a podcast called Theme Park This. It is a podcast where we take a movie or a TV show or a book or serial mascot and we turn it into a theme park. So we just recently did an episode on BioShock. We've got an episode coming out about General Mills serial mascots. Did an episode on The Simpsons. It's a lot of fun. It's a fun show.
Are you telling me there's a Tony the Tiger ride?
No, he is Kellogg's. He's not General Mills.
I was going to listen to it. Now you lost me.
No, So mine was my pitch was essentially Splash Mountain, but with Lucky the Leprechaun from Lucky Charms, and also pitch a dark ride based on Chip the dog from Cookie Crisp. You help Cookie Chip the dog get his Cookie Crisp back from Cookie Cop.
Just say that sentence
it's
a
like
couple
Mr.
more
Toad's
times.
Wild Ride, but with explosives and
okay. You know. Stop digging your head oil. You got me with Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. Brian, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Brian for joining me. You can find me on Twitter at Robbie Dorman, and my website is robbiedorman.com. You'll find links there for my other podcasts and a link to purchase my horror novels, including my newest novel, War on Halloween. Where an Halloween is a suspense horror story about a family fighting for Halloween in a town controlled by a sinister reverend with secret occult powers. You can pre-order it now on Amazon. The show's website is serialfanatics.com. If you like the show, please give it a 5-star review on iTunes or whatever podcast service you use. So subscribing, tell your friends, all those things help. I appreciate it. Until next time, thanks for being a fan.